We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for the show, Harriet Williams, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking with Adrienne Eaton. She chairs the Labor Studies and Employment Relations Department at Rutgers University. And as a scholar in her work, she does a lot of writing about organized labor. And she also has been very much involved there at Rutgers with organizing the faculty at that school. And she is here to talk. She's visiting the campus. The Campus Faculty Association is sponsoring her visit. She's here to talk about collective bargaining, and we'll be giving a talk today. That's at 6:30 this evening.
Last night.
Oh, my apologies. Last night. This was last night. Well, you missed it, and it was very exciting. She's been good enough, though, to spend some extra time here with us, so we can perhaps talk about some of these same issues, and particularly about how it is that faculty are thinking about the kinds of financial pressures that are now coming to bear on public colleges and universities across the country, because very clearly they are struggling with a big problem, and that is declining support from their states. And as a result, in a lot of places, they have increased tuition. They have made classes bigger. And we have seen a trend that we've actually seen for some time now with increasing reliance on part-time faculty, people who are either part-time or perhaps they're full-time, but they're not tenure track. And this is something that a lot of people who teach for a living in a higher education are really concerned about. So we'll try to talk a little bit about that. Questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. So at any point here, folks certainly can call in, be part of the conversation. Email also is a possibility, too, and that's will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. So what, obviously you can't speak for all college faculty across the country, but do you have a sense of how it is that people in higher education, people who are teachers, think about where we are now with the support for higher education?
You know, frankly, I think a lot of faculty don't think about it. You know, it's out there in the ether. They're worried about it, but they want to just do their day-to-day work. They want to focus on their research. They want to focus on their teaching, and they don't want to have that responsibility. And I think that's one of the big shifts that's taking place, is that the scope of the job is really changing, where increasingly we have to be thinking about how we're going to bring money in for our units. And that's a big change. That's not anything people were trained to do in graduate school or particularly want to think about.
So we're talking about grants, about funding for their research projects. Are we really getting to a point where more and more people are going to have to think about, if I'm going to do a certain, whatever I'm going to do, whatever my work is, I'm going to have to go out there and find the money to pay for this?
Well, I think, you know, maybe in the sciences it's about grants, and that's not a big change, I don't think. But I think it's more about going after students, finding students, looking at formulas for tuition sharing. So my university, for instance, has something called all funds budgeting. It's a decentralized budgeting system. And so tuition dollars are actually returned to the units based on particular formulas. And the formulas are different for whether they're your majors or not, or your graduate students or in another program. The formula is different for whether the program is off campus or on campus. Online education is more lucrative. So you have to start thinking about what kinds of mix of students you want. You need to have a business model, essentially. And again, that's just not something most faculty have ever had to think about or want to think about.
Well, I'm really intrigued by this notion of going after students. How exactly do you do that?
We have a whole marketing program in my school. So I'm in a school of management labor relations. It's a professional school and relatively small compared to a school of arts and sciences, for instance. But we are actually investing money in an advertising firm who's writing advertisements for us. We advertise in the student newspaper on our campus. We position classes at times that we think will draw students. So it's just, it's really a whole marketing program. Mm. You know, the whole idea of branding. We've had marketing consultants come and do focus groups with both our current students and prospective students. So again, this is something, you know, nobody who was trained in labor relations thought they were going to be doing marketing. Mm-hmm. And yet that's a way that we've really been able to keep our student numbers up in a very healthy kind of way. And my school is actually doing quite well financially compared to some others at Rutgers.
Yeah. Where do you know, one of the maybe it's a fact of life now about higher education is the cost, just for the students, the cost continues to go up, and it seems that every year we have to have, we do, and I'm sure every place else, every year they have to increase the tuition. How do people think about that, and is that something that faculty just end up having to accept as just a fact of life, because there, I don't imagine there's really much that they can do about that.
Well, you know, yeah, that's, it's really, it's a tough question. And I think, again, a lot of faculty don't want to think about it very deeply. I think that faculty are troubled by the issues that that presents for access, particularly for poor students or lower middle class students or even middle class students at this point. So it's becoming increasingly difficult to afford a public institution of higher education. And I think that that's worrisome, and people see it in the mix of students they have. But I don't think they're quite sure what to do about it. What are the options with decreasing state, you know, direct state support? Yes, you can do more grant getting, but that's mm-hmm. increasingly difficult, too. There are some pots of money that are shrinking. Some of the federal money, I think, increased with the ARRA, the Recovery Act, but that's probably not going to last. It's probably going to change soon. So, you know, what choice is there really except to put that burden on students? And, you know, there's the possibility of creating new programs, new degree programs, and attracting new students. I think virtually all of the public institutions, the big state universities at least, part of their business plan is to attract more out-of-state tuitions, because that's more out-of-state students. That's more, you know, higher tuition and more lucrative. And I just look at it and think, okay, so now we're all going to be trading our kids across state boundaries so that we can all do better. That doesn't, and again, what choice do you have? But it doesn't seem like it's going to work out in the long run. Hmm. I know, I'm sure that this campus and my campus as well are very interested in attracting international students, you know, who are going to be able to pay more tuition and bring real interesting diversity to the classroom. So that's another one of the business strategies.
Mm-hmm. We're talking this morning in this hour with Adrienne Eaton. She chairs the Labor Studies and Employment Relations Department at Rutgers University, and is here visiting the campus, is here to talk with people on this campus about faculty organizing. And it's been good enough to come and spend a little time talking with us about some of the pressures that have now come to bear because of the economic situation that we have, a declining state support for public universities, what that really means for faculty and how people are thinking about that. And again, your questions are certainly welcome. Comments, questions, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, email wilt-talk@illinois.edu. And I wonder if this if it has really put faculty in a position to an extent that they never have before, to had to kind of think about what the cost of doing business is, you know, what all the various costs involved in running the university are, and about, you know, are they experiencing pressure to trim costs, but then are they also turning to the administration and saying to them, well, you know, do we need as many administrators as we have? Do we need to be, happening at that level of the university?
Yeah, well, that's a really key question, and there's a lot of concern and interest in budget transparency that I think probably wasn't there before. That's a big struggle on my campus, and there's a lot of agitation, for instance, around the football program at Rutgers. So Rutgers has not been a big football school, and but over the last 10 years or so has really been investing heavily in the football program, has a highly paid coach, and you know, had a very good year a couple years ago, and it did translate into a lot more interest and inquiries that, you know, you can trace the numbers in terms of people calling and probably applicants, too. I'm not so sure about that, and I don't know about the yield. But then the team hasn't done so well in the last couple of years. The university built an addition to the stadium, spent a lot of money. So in a period of retrenchment in the academic program, there's a lot of money going into athletics. The university shifted $11 million last summer from the general fund into the athletic budget at the same time that they froze salaries for everybody who works in the university. So there are real questions about that kind of spending in particular. What are the priorities? We look around and we see buildings going up on our campus all over the place. Why is there money for building new buildings and not for the people who work there? So I think as long as salaries and benefits are healthy and not changing, the faculty are all in favor of spending on those things, really. But when it starts to be those priorities are competing, then the questions really come up. Mm-hmm. And in some units in my university, faculty lost phones in their offices, for instance. Will that get your attention in a way that other kinds of cuts might not?
Mm-hmm. It's certainly perfectly natural, understandable, appropriate that university faculty, like any other workers, they're concerned with their wages and working conditions and trying to have the best of both. And at the same time here, they're in institutions that have this financial pressure on them. I'm sure faculty are also concerned about rising cost of tuition and larger class size and what the student experience is. And they're also concerned about this increase in the numbers of contingent faculty. So I wonder how you think about this. It seems that we have two kind of interests that are pulling in opposite directions. You know, faculty, they're entitled to make a living and they want to make a living. And now here we have faculty that are facing wage freezes and wondering what their financial situation is going to be. So they have that set of interests for themselves, but they also have this other set of interests, I'm sure, for the institution and for students. How do people reconcile those two things?
I don't know if they really do reconcile. And I would say that, you know, the opinions about that vary a lot. So Rutgers is a relatively well-paid faculty because it's been unionized for 40-plus years. We're at the top of the pay scales for some of the ranks. So up in the full professor ranks or the distinguished professor ranks, I think people do tend to be more focused and more concerned on the student access issues, the rising tuition issues. But, you know, at the same time, there are non-tenure-tracked instructors making minimum salaries. There are assistant professors who are really struggling. New Jersey is an incredibly expensive place to live. It's really impossible to buy a house for a family without two incomes. I think those lower ranks, the lower paid people do tend to focus more on their own situation. I don't want to say that they're not thinking about the students, but I think it's much tougher for them to get beyond their own particular interests. My union, my faculty and TAGA union is trying to work in coalition with student groups on campus around the tuition issue so that we don't get pitted against each other. And certainly the administration, when it talks about faculty salaries, wants to blame the rising tuition rates on the faculty and on rising faculty salaries. If you actually graph those two things together, there's not a very good story to be told by them. Mm-hmm. One is not driving the other. It's really the declining state support that's driving the increase in tuition, and you can see that pretty directly. So, as a faculty union, we're trying to really work with the student groups on campus around access and to try and support not increasing tuition. But we're in a very tricky place because that is a significant source of revenue.
Hmm. To what extent are university faculties unionized now? I know Rutgers is one of the really big ones.
Yeah, you know, that's a good question, and I ought to know the answer to it, and I don't. Unionization has not been a phenomenon of the big public research universities, and Rutgers is unusual in that. I think that is going to be changing. The AFT, the American Federation of Teachers, and the AAUP, American Association of University Professors, and we're an affiliate of both of those organizations. They have a joint organizing program that is oriented around going after some of the big research universities. So they're trying to figure out how to do that together, and they're working on particular campuses and think they're going to have some successes soon. So, you know, what percentage, I honestly don't know. Obviously, many do have their teaching assistants organized. Part-time lecturers or adjuncts are organized on many campuses, and really a surprising number of faculty.
Mm-hmm. Why is it that, though, historically that hasn't been something that university professors have really, they just seem not to have seen themselves as either needing it or as maybe as, who knows, maybe they just think that, well, this is not the kind of occupation that that does that.
Right. I think that that's part of it. It's the identification of the organized labor movement with blue collar work, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, professors are not unlike doctors in a sense. They're very highly skilled professionals. They often work very individually. They may not have a lot of identification with the particular university that they work at. It's just, I think, something that they haven't seen a model that makes sense to them. They worry about, you know, extensive work rules and that kind of thing. But then if you look at my union or other examples where a research university has been organized, you'll see a much more flexible form of professional unionism that I think is quite different from the UAW or, you know, a blue-collar union. I think that I try to think of it as like athletes, you know, that there are the very best or most in demand, the star professors who really probably don't need that kind of collective protection. Mm-hmm. But the masses of us do, at least for certain kinds of things. And we think about it a little bit like the Football Players Association, for instance, that, yes, the top players are going to negotiate individually great salaries for themselves, but you need to protect the bottom and you need to be looking out. You need to set a floor, basically, and not worry about the ceiling, because those folks will take care of themselves.
We have a caller here to talk with. Let's do that. Champaign County, here where we are. It's line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'm an academic professional here at the university, so I do have a contract. I have been in my position for just over 3 years, but I also started my doctoral program in 2000, and I'm in the same college that in which I now work. So I've been around the university for about 10 years, and one of the things that I've noticed in the last year is just an amazing exodus of faculty from the university because of the budget problems. And these are generally more the junior faculty, the younger faculty, and the best and the brightest who are able to get positions elsewhere. And it seems rather than moving towards a union that a lot of the faculty are just simply leaving the ones who are able to. And the university is relying more and more on non-tenured faculty, whether they be visiting faculty or clinical faculty or, you know, however they want to label an adjunct. When I started in 2000, I asked my advisor at the time, because I know at Eastern Illinois University, the faculty is unionized, and I was really surprised that the University of Illinois wasn't. And he said that they told me that there probably will never be a faculty union at the university because the top-tier faculty, the ones that you were just talking about, would never accept the pay cut that they would have to take in order to have a fair union around the university. And I'm just wondering, you know, what your comment might be on something like that.
Well, you might want that person to look at the salaries at Rutgers University, because nobody has taken a pay cut from being unionized. And on the contrary, the high end is quite high end at my university. So, you know, some of the big scientists, we've got law school professors making a lot of money. Now, we don't have a medical school, which makes some of the salary comparisons a little difficult. But there is no ceiling. We have a process in our contract called the out of cycle process. And that is the process by which salaries are raised when somebody goes on the market. So it's It's a contractual process that has some protections and some role from the department. The department gets to sort of comment on whether somebody should get a salary increase, but you can go out on the market and come back with an offer, or not even an offer, but just indications that people are interested in you, and negotiate up your salary. The union has a right to see copies of all of those deals. We're notified of them, and despite the fact that we're having a general salary freeze, these out-of-cycles are ongoing, and I've seen them $50,000 increases, $25,000 increases. So people are going out and, you know, now some people might object to this process, but there is no top. It's not about the top getting salary cuts in any way in my union.
Well, and one of the problems we put up with here, too, is not just with the state budget, but even with the lowering of state contributions. They just simply weren't making the contributions. There was a point this year in which the state was $560 million behind in its payments to the university. And if there's no money, you know, there's nothing that you can do. But, you know, I can say that those of us that are in unions, you know, have been talking with and working with faculty and other people who don't have contractual representation, and offering to do anything we can to assist in their forming, you know, an organization if that's the way they'd like to go. And is there anything else that you think that, you know, the other non-faculty employees of university can do to assist faculty in coming to the, you know, a decision, or at least to the point of wanting to cast a vote to see which way they want to go?
You know, that's a good question. My experience at Rutgers is the other way around, where the faculty were organized and the professional staff organized the last. It was the last group at the university. So in that case, the faculty really supported that organizing. I'm not sure that it works the other way around, because faculty are, frankly, so full of themselves. I don't know that they will pay a lot of attention to staff. But, you know, it's possible to I guess, reduce some of the concerns and for faculty to see how unions handle themselves on campus. It's an example of unionism in the higher ed environment, so I think that could be helpful.
Well, we just always let them know that we're available. I thank you very much for your time and your answers.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We hear about it our midpoint in this hour of focus. Our guest is Adrienne Eaton. She is chair of the Labor Studies and Employment Relations Department at Rutgers University. She writes in her academic work about labor management relations and labor organizing. She also happens to be the president of the faculty union there at Rutgers. And she's here visiting the campus. She was the first in a series of speakers that faculty here have brought to get people here talking about some of the economic problems, the crisis that affects public universities across the country. And she talked last night on the campus, and we're pleased that she could spend a little time here with us. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. I have a question here that came in by email. I don't know whether you'll be able to give an answer, but here the person writes, based on rates of changes in average personal income over the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years versus the rise in the cost of education, are there accepted predictions about the percentage of people who will be college educated in 10, 15, 20, and 25 years versus today? So I guess the question is, given what we know about the increasing costs, what can we say about the number of people who will be able to go to college, and what does that mean for the country?
Yeah, I don't think that I know the specific answer to that. I don't know that I've seen any study of that, though I'm sure the projections have been done. So I think that there are certainly worries about that, and I think there's a lot of questions about whether this is in particular, a good time to be disinvesting in public higher ed. You know, it's an economic engine for the particular states that the schools are in and for the country as a whole. And so I think that is a very worrisome trend. I haven't unlike some people, I haven't given up on the idea that there will be tax dollars spent on in public higher ed. And there's a lot of cynicism and worry about that in New Jersey, and I think that that's right in the short run. We have a new Republican governor who's very hostile to public sector unions and is interested in shrinking state government. But even he has said that the state has been underinvesting in public higher ed. And if he had money, we would be getting some of it. You know, that's kind of easy for him to say because there isn't a lot of money to go around in the state right now. But it's not clear to me that this downward trend will continue forever. I just feel like at some point people are going to wake up for the reasons that that person is suggesting with that question, really, that at some point it becomes a problem for the nation's economy if people are not continuing to have access to higher education.
Well, that's, and maybe someone will say that this is a self-serving comment on my part, being an employee of the state and employee of the university. But I guess I continue to find myself wondering why it is that it seems to be such a hard sell to try to persuade people that supporting education broadly, I mean, supporting all of your schools, but particularly supporting your universities. Why does it seem to be such a hard sell that that's the engine that helps drive your economy? And that if you don't have an educated workforce, well, then your economy is not going to be successful.
Well, I think that's a good question, and I don't know that I have an answer to it. I think that higher education has not done a very good job at that itself, of kind of making that argument and promoting it. And I know that's actually something that the union has worked on, not directly with the university, but we're on the same message with the state legislature about that. And, you know, some of our state legislators who are friendly to the university are kind of surprised to think about the university in those terms as an economic development agency, as an engine, economic development engine. So I do think that there's some fault from higher ed itself of not making that case. I just think it's more, you know, just short-term thinking on the part of legislatures that they are in budget-cutting mode, and universities and colleges are an easy place to do it because they know they have other sources of income. They can raise tuition. They can bring in more grants. They can do fundraising. And my institution's very successful at those other things. So even though the state support has been dwindling, the university is growing and prospering in a lot of ways. Now, whether that can continue, it's hard to say. But legislators look at that and they probably think to themselves, oh, yeah, we were right. We could cut the university and it would be fine.
Yeah. I do find myself wondering if part of it has to do with the fact that maybe a lot of faculty are not exactly comfortable in that arena. You know, they're not exactly comfortable with that role. University presidents and administrators, they have to do that. That comes with the job. And I suppose that all universities maybe have some people whose job it is, whose specific job it is to lobby, to represent the interests of their universities there in the Capitol. But for most faculty, that's just, you know, they have other things to do. And as I say, maybe they would feel a little bit uneasy about being put into that position.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. We have a president at Rutgers who is not very good in this role, I have to say, and I'm sorry to say it, and I won't say a lot more about it on the radio, but he has not been terrific with governors and with many of the most powerful legislators either. And in fact, we do have some faculty who are very effective in that arena, and some of them are in that arena because of connections with the university and some of them through the union. We bring legislators on to campus. We try and do that a couple times a year. We have a legislative breakfast and we invite anyone who wants to come. The university invites legislators onto campus, you know, to look at particular labs and to talk with faculty about research projects and the implications for medical science. We've got, as many universities do, a stem cell initiative, for instance, and the faculty leader of that initiative is in Trenton a lot talking to legislators and has talked to the governor. So, you do see some of that at Rutgers, and we talked about how to do a little better job at that. We did, in the past, we've done a videotaped thing where we've interviewed members of the faculty to talk about projects that we thought would really get the attention of legislators, or to talk about their teaching, which is something obviously that legislators are probably most concerned about is what kind of undergraduate education is being provided by the university. Mm-hmm. So I do think, actually, that we've done some of that and could probably do more.
Back just for a moment to the subject of organizing faculty, that has obvious benefits for the faculty. Can you make a kind of an argument that says, yes, organizing the faculty has benefits for the faculty, but that it also has some kind of benefit for the university? Can you make an argument like that?
Well, I can. And it's interesting. I was talking about this last night. Rutgers organized pretty early on in the history of public sector bargaining in the state of New Jersey. So we have bargaining dating from, I think, the late 1960s, possibly a year or two before the Public Sector Bargaining Act was actually passed in the state. And it was a voluntary recognition by the university. And at the time, and this has to do with the peculiar history of Rutgers, which is an amalgamation of a private men's college, Rutgers College, a private women's college, Douglas College, the land-grant agricultural school, Cook College. But the salaries were very low in those days, is my understanding. Obviously, this is way before my time. But the salaries were very low, and the president of the university at the time thought that unionization would actually help to elevate both the salaries and therefore the quality of the faculty. And I think actually it turned out to be quite a good strategy. So, you know, paying the faculty well is means that you're going to recruit good quality faculty and is good for the university. And I think even the university administration thinks in those terms. They maybe don't want to pay everybody quite as well as the union. You know, the union fights for across-the-board increases, and the university is more interested on the merit side. But in fact, our salaries are 50-50. We've got a kind of 50-50 formula for that. So I think that there's lots of ways in which the union can enhance the quality of the university, and that's certainly how I think about it, and the recent leadership of my union has really thought about, yes, we're here to represent the interests of members, but we're also interested in the university thriving and the academic excellence, as the administration likes to talk about all the time.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with someone here on the phone, someone in Kankakee, line 4.
Hi, thank you.
Yes.
I find it interesting that your speaker invokes capitalist principles and methods to get money into the university, but somehow doesn't talk about capitalist principles of accountability for what the university is producing. In other words, if you're running the university like a business, which I don't think you should, especially if you're a state school, why aren't professors more accountable for what they produce? Now, my father was a tenured professor. My brother is a tenured professor. Both of them say tenure is a bad system. It allows academics to become lazy and non-productive. Its rules aren't enforced. Many of their colleagues are either working at private jobs, making a lot more money outside the university whenever they can, or frankly, they're on the golf course. Why shouldn't, like, lower education, where the unions protect the bad performing teachers, why shouldn't somehow the universities become more accountable?
Well, you asked two different questions there. One is about the faculty's accountability, and the other is about institutional accountability. There's a lot of different answers to that, but I just want to say my colleagues are not on the golf course. People are working incredibly hard, and this goes back to my answer to the very first question about what are faculty thinking about. Increasingly, faculty not only are doing their research and their teaching, but are also, as I said, really sort of taking on the business model, thinking about how to grow programs, how to start new programs, being entrepreneurial, as we talk about on our campus. So whether or not, and again, I said faculty don't want to be doing that often, are not trained to do that, but are having to take that responsibility. So the people that I know at the university are, in fact, working their butts off and are tired. Their research productivity is often declining because they're off doing this marketing and thinking hard about how to grow programs or building new programs to bring in new tuition dollars. Now, I don't disagree that there aren't what the administration in my university and others like to call dead wood, and I'm all for thinking about fair procedures to get a handle on that. I'm not at all opposed to thinking about that. But I just totally disagree about tenure. You know, you need to look at the origins of the tenure system and academic freedom and its meaning and some of the abuses that that took place and still do take place around political judgments, particularly in a public sector university where a legislator hears about a research project and thinks it's inappropriate. It doesn't agree with a professor politically. Just you can imagine the kinds of things that would go on without the protection of tenure. So I can't agree with you there.
How often does that really happen? I mean, there's an argument, I think, to be made that tenure has outlived itself or its original purposes and goals.
I just don't see that. I just, you know, the sort of motivations from the forces that would involve themselves in the university haven't changed. It doesn't happen very often because there's tenure. But without tenure, I think you would see it a whole lot more. Now, you know, some of the people that you might defend, I always think about the Ward Churchill case, you know, in Colorado, and it was in some ways difficult to defend him. And of course, ultimately, he was nailed supposedly for plagiarism. I don't know any of the details of that, but you know, the free speech rights within the university, not just of the faculty but of students, are just essential to the research mission and to the teaching mission. And you just can't have that without the protection of tenure. And again, I don't think that means you should support people who are out on the golf course. I don't see very much of that. But if that's going on, then there ought to be mechanisms to deal with it. So I think people should be accountable. I agree with that.
Well, you know, educational costs have outpaced inflation by at least a factor of two for at least the last couple of decades. Now, how is it that we should somehow spend more money on what we're already spending money on, either through outright grants to universities from the government or cheap student aid? How is it that we should be putting more money into it then? In other words, it's already outpaced inflation, definitely outpaced my salary. Last two decades. Now I've got to pay for my kids to go to college, and I'm not going to be able to afford it. And I'm also seeing a diminishing return again because, again, I don't think the schools are performing. Why should we put more money into this?
Well, I'd like to know what your metrics are for performance, I guess. I'd be really interested to know why you think that they're not performing. I mean, all of the indicators are that still, and even in, you know, this environment with very high unemployment, where certainly there are college-educated people who are unemployed and recent graduates are having a hard time getting placed, the evidence is still quite clear that a college education makes a huge difference. There's a huge premium in salaries for a college education.
Well, let me give you one common complaint. The common complaint you hear is that grad students are basically teaching the star professor's courses. In other words, you may be paying these guys, the rock stars of the academic world, to stay, but they're not teaching class. They're grad students. I hear that over and over again. My brother tells me it's true.
Yeah, I'm not going to completely disagree with that. There is some of that. I'm the product of a University of Michigan. I went there as an undergraduate, but I have to tell you, I had a teaching assistant in my biological anthropology course who is now one of the most famous anthropologists, biological anthropologist of human evolution in the world. So I think I did pretty well actually having him as a, not as the sole teacher, by the way, just as the teacher of my section. So that's true that there are star professors who don't teach very much. They tend to teach graduate students. It's not that they're not teaching, but they're often in their labs teaching in a more individualized way, particularly in the sciences.
I'm going to jump in here. I appreciate the comments of the caller, and I acknowledge that they're good questions. And I don't think it's real fair to have our guest here to have to defend all of public higher education in the country. One thing, though, I guess I do find myself wondering, and I'm sure from time to time there has been a fairly consistently people have raised questions about tenure. Do we need tenure? And are there people who are who have their jobs and keep their jobs because of tenure, but they're really actually not doing anything? You know, those sorts of questions, I think they've probably been asked over time. What I wonder is, at this point, at where we are now, are you hearing that more and more? Are people raising that question about more and more raising that question, do we need tenure?
Yeah, I think that that question is being raised more. I thought you were going to ask about, are we hearing more and more concerns about deadwood, which is easier to talk about within the university.
Well.
So, you know, yeah, when the majority of faculty are, as I said, working their butts off, really are working very intensively. If you look at, you know, studies of reported work hours for faculty, you'll see that they're certainly higher in average. Women in academics, in academic jobs, in faculty positions have fewer children on average than other professional women, which I think tells you something about workload, actually. It's very interesting. Hmm. So I do think that there's worry about that. You see pressures in my university. We just had a retirement incentive program that picked off, I think, a lot of what the university probably considered as the tired folks who'd been there a long time. And we're talking about people in their 70s and even into their 80s in some cases. So that's an issue, that there's no retirement age in academia. So you do get people working to a pretty ripe old age. And some of those folks are very vibrant, and some of them are not so much. So, yeah, I think there's questioning of tenure, just as there is in public schools. Again, my answer would not be to do away with tenure, but to think about other accountability mechanisms. And merit pay is a tool for that. It's supposed to be a tool for that. I'm not sure it's used very, very well, but it probably could be thought through more. I would argue that universities are not terribly well-managed places, particularly the kind of human resource management function for faculty in particular. It's not the best thinking about that topic is not going to university management, the best corporate thinking about that. So there are kinds of accountability issues, I think, that could be done better.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Adrienne Eaton is our guest. She chairs the Labor Studies and Employment Relations Department at Rutgers University, where she's also president of the Rutgers Faculty Union. She's here visiting the campus, was here to talk with faculty here about the subject of collective bargaining for faculty, but also as part of a kind of a series that faculty here are trying to put together to encourage some conversation about some of the challenges facing public universities today. And questions are welcome, and we have a couple of other people, and we'll try to get in. In fact, we now have several. We'll try to get them all in the time that remains. People can help us by trying to be brief, but we certainly would like to give people time to say what they have to say. And we'll start out here again with Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. I attended a talk by Kerry Nelson, whom I'm sure you're acquainted with, on how unions can save higher education. And it was very illuminating on this last going forth on tenure. He was pointing out that, I mean, 30 years ago, 2 out of 3 professorial level instructors were tenured, and now it's the reverse. Only 1 out of 3 are. So effectively, a lot of the people who are supposed to be shaping minds and promoting discourse and making moral education part of this, as opposed to just the idea of what can be done to stimulate the economy, are subject to censure and dismissal, it seems to me. When we have legislators in this area talking about the music faculty, music education faculty, asking people to think about what they're doing when they're participating in the chief ritual, calling these educators advocating a Maoist re-education camp, we obviously see that there are a lot of things that are at stake. Now, it seems to me that perhaps you want to react to that. There's a lot here tied up. The fact that tenure is actually not a factor in a lot of people's terms of with the university.
No, that is a good point. And, you know, the majority of faculty around the country are no longer tenure track, and it's a diminishing percentage every year. I can't pull the number out of my hat. But there is a lot of concern about that. I know that there's an argument that basically no contingent faculty has true academic freedom because they're at risk at all times. You know, how much abuse is there really of that? I don't know what you were referring to particularly, but you know, I'm not sure. It's not an area of focus of mine.
Okay. I want to thank the call. We just, have a couple of minutes. I want to try to get at least one other. This is someone in Champaign, line two. Hello.
Yes. I just wanted to note, I just caught this in the last 10, 15 minutes or so, but I heard the earlier callers and so forth. The center of the problem here, in my view, as an administrator at the university and so forth, is that, and faculty, is lack of state support. For whatever reason, the legislators and the public in Illinois have chosen, I suppose, to not properly fund the university. And so last year, out of the $800 million of our budget that the state gives us, which is only 17% of the budget, they only gave us at the end of the year $500 million of that. We didn't even see most of the money for most of the year. And so you have, you know, this terrible situation in which you simply do not have proper state support. On the other hand, there is a second issue, I think, which is that there are too many top administrators at most major universities, and there's been a drastic increase in the numbers of these people, including on our campus. And that is a problem because they make tremendously high salaries, and of course they give the public the wrong impression in many ways. And so I think this has very little to do with tenure. And I can tell you that in my particular department we had roughly two secretaries about 7 or 8 years ago. We have one-third of a secretary now. We ourselves do a lot of secretarial work. Faculty work far harder than they did when I started teaching about 15 years ago. It's extremely grueling, and it's not, unfortunately, going to get better probably in the state of Illinois. But I'm curious how it is in your case in New Jersey, but I just wanted to offer my perspective on that.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I really I appreciate that and agree with most of what you had to say. And I was talking about the increased workloads. And yes, my own unit hasn't suffered with the secretarial issue so much, but certainly many others have. So that's right. And it would have been one of the things I wanted to say to that earlier caller about the increase in cost of higher ed is that that cost is a lot in administration and not in faculty, in fact.
Right. I again want to thank the caller. We'll try to get one more caller here in Seattle, Washington. Line four. Hello.
Hi. I was just calling to react to that earlier caller, same one, I think. My understanding of the rise in cost of education for students was that grant funding, state funding have been getting cut over and over and over again for, I don't know, a decade or longer. And the question, why should we pay more, is not even applicable. If you've already cut down to, I don't know what the percentage is now, but if it's being cut over and over again, there is no paying more. You've been paying less over and over again, and students pay more is what happens. But anyway, that's all.
All right. Well, I don't know. Anything you want to add to that?
No, I thought that that's kind of what he was implying, is that the students are paying more. He's paying more for his kids to go to college, and that's right. It's cost shifting. So it's money out of the tax dollars but into the individual students and their families.
Well, we're coming down to the point here. We have 2-3 minutes left. Where do you think all of this is going to go? It seems to me that at least people on this campus are not optimistic that these sorts of trends, that any of this is really going to change, and everybody's just trying to hold on.
Yeah, I think that's true. Well, I don't know. I like to think of myself as an optimist at heart. And as I said earlier, I am not convinced that the declining state support is forever and ever. You know, we've got more tough years ahead of us in terms of the economy, the U.S. economy, and the economy of this state, I'm sure, and my state as well. But I really am hopeful that when that turns around, that there will be reinvestment in higher education, that we'll be able to make the case for it, and that legislators will see that colleges, public higher ed, and therefore higher ed period is starting to get out of reach for many middle class families, and do something about that.
You know, here on this campus, people have been involved in a very broad and intensive effort to look at everything the university does, asking questions about what's the core mission, what must we do, what can we afford to do, what can we not afford to do. And also I think that there has been an acknowledgement that there may be room to cut on the administrative level. So they're trying to look at everything, which really gets to a question about the future university. That is, what universities are going to look like in the future, and whether they're going to be substantially different places, do you think?
Well, if the trends in faculty hiring go on with the shrinkage of tenure track faculty, I think that they are, you know, if that's true, it is going to look like a different place. And I think what we really worry about is the sort of University of Phoenix model, where you have very few core faculty. They don't necessarily have tenure track, but full-time faculty, and it's really a part-time, almost completely a part-time operation. And that's just a completely different animal than what we've all been used to for higher education in the U.S.
Aside from the issues of academic freedom, and I don't want to make it sound like I think that's not a big issue. It certainly is. Aside from that, what's really the problem with having more and more of these contingent faculty?
Well, you know, if they're full time non tenure track, that's one thing. But the part timers just don't have the time to work with students. They don't have time. They're not on campus. They are juggling often shocking teaching loads, 8 courses in some cases, and that I think has to raise questions about the quality of the teaching. But also, they're not there for advising. They're not there for mentoring. They're not there in all the other kinds of roles that faculty play in the lives of students that is really important.
Well, I think we're just about the point where we have to finish up. It's you said before that you were by nature maybe an optimist. It just seems it's a difficult environment in which to be optimistic.
Well, this is a difficult environment to be optimistic about the future of the U.S. economy, about the future of the labor movement, and of the future of public higher ed. So I think that's all true. But optimists try and deny reality to some extent to stay optimistic. But, you know, again, I just hope that people are going to take a look and realize that the access to higher education is really dwindling. And that's been an essential element of the American century, if that's what the last century was, and needs to be an essential element of the one going forward.
Our guest, Adrienne Eaton, she chairs the Labor Studies and Employment Relations Department at Rutgers University, where she is also president of the Rutgers Faculty Union. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.